firms, business services, medical practices, and social service organizations had been automating and streamlining themselves along with the manufacturing sector and the rest of the economy. No one could convincingly explain why the statistics were off, I said. Some argued that the service purchases by goods manufacturers were being mispriced in the calculations, and that the growth of total output per hour was correct, but goods production and output per hour were being overestimated at the expense of service output and productivity growth. While technically possible, this explanation seemed very unlikely. But I was reasonably confident that the risk of inflation was too weak to warrant a rate hike. My recommendation was that we simply watch and wait. This argument didn't convince everyone. Indeed, we are still debating the nature and extent of information technology's impact on productivity. But it cast enough reasonable doubt that the committee voted 11-1 to keep the rate where it was, at 5.25%. We did not find it necessary to raise rates for another 6 months, and then only to 5.5%, and for a different reason. GDP continued to grow at a solid pace, unemployment shrank, and inflation stayed in check for another 4 years. By not being too quick to raise rates, we helped clear the way for the post-war period's longest economic boom. This was a classic example of why you can't just decide monetary policy based on an econometric model. As Joseph Schumpeter might have pointed out, models are subject to creative destruction too. Even rising productivity could not explain the looniness of stock prices. On October 14, 1996, the Dow Jones Industrial Average vaulted past 6,000, a milestone achieved, declared a front-page story in USA Today, on the opening day of the seventh year of the most consistent bull market in history. Papers all across the country put the news on the front page, too. The New York Times noted that more and more Americans were shifting their retirement savings into stocks, reflecting a widespread belief that the stock market is the only place to make long-term investments. America was turning into a shareholders' nation. If you compared the total value of stock holdings with the size of the economy, the market's significance was increasing at a rapid rate. At $9.5 trillion, it now was 120% as large as GDP. That was up from 60% in 1990, a ratio topped only by Japan at the height of its 1980s bubble. I had ongoing conversations with Bob Rubin on the subject. We were both somewhat concerned. We'd now seen the Dow break through three millennium marks, 4,000, 5,000, and 6,000, in just over a year and a half. Though economic growth was strong, we worried that investors were getting carried away. Stock prices were beginning to embody expectations so exorbitant that they could never be met. A stock market boom, of course, is an economic plus. It predisposes businesses to expand, makes consumers feel flush, and helps the economy to grow. Even a crash is not automatically bad. The crash of 1987, hair-raising though we'd felt it to be, had very few lingering negative effects. Only when a collapsing market might threaten to hamstring the real economy is there cause for people like the Treasury Secretary and the Chairman of the Fed to worry. We'd seen that sort of disaster happen in Japan, where the economy was still crippled from a stock and real estate collapse in 1990. While neither Bob nor I thought the United States had yet reached the bubble stage, we couldn't help but notice that more and more households and businesses were exposing themselves to equity risks. So, over breakfast, we often discussed what we should do in the event of a bubble. Bob thought that a federal financial official should never talk about the stock market in public. An inveterate maker of lists, he offered three reasons noted subsequently in his memoirs. First, there's no way to know for certain when a market is overvalued or undervalued, he said. Second, you can't fight market forces, so talking about it won't do any good. And third, anything you say is likely to backfire and hurt your credibility. People will realize you don't know more than anybody else. I had to admit that all of those things were true, but I still didn't agree that raising the issue in public was necessarily a bad idea. The growing importance of the stock market was impossible to deny. How could you talk about the economy without mentioning the 800-pound gorilla? While the Fed had no explicit mandate to focus on the stock market, the effects of the run-up in prices seemed to me a legitimate concern. In quelling inflation, we had established that price stability is central to long-term economic growth. In fact, One major factor causing stock prices to rise was investors' growing confidence that stability would continue. Yet the concept of price stability wasn't as self-evident as it seemed. There were probably 10 different statistical series on prices you could look at. For most economists, price stability referred to product prices, the cost of a pair of socks or a quart of milk. But what about the prices of income-earning assets, like stocks or real estate? What if those prices were to inflate and become unstable? Shouldn't we worry about the price stability of nest eggs and not just the eggs you buy at the grocery store? It wasn't that I wanted to stand up and shout, "The stock market is overvalued and it will lead to no good." I didn't believe that, but I thought it important to put the issue on the table. The concept of irrational exuberance came to me in the bathtub one morning as I was writing a speech. To this day, the bathtub is where I get many of my best ideas. My assistants have gotten used to typing from drafts scrawled on damp yellow pads, a chore that got much easier once we found a kind of pen whose ink doesn't run. Immersed in my bath, I'm as happy as Archimedes as I contemplate the world. After the Dow had broken 6,000 in mid-October 1996, I'd begun looking for an opportunity to speak up about asset values. I decided that the American Enterprise Institute's annual dinner on December 5th, where I'd agreed to give the keynote address, would be perfect. It's a major black tie affair that attracts more than 1,000 people, including many Washington public policy experts, and it comes early enough in the holiday season to count as a serious event. To put the stock market question in proper perspective, I thought I should embed it in a capsule history of U.S. central banking. I reached all the way back to Alexander Hamilton and William Jennings Bryan and worked my way up to the present and the future. A more general audience might have been put off by the wonkiness of this approach, but it was about the right speed for the American Enterprise Institute crowd. I wrote the speech so that the issue of asset values accounted for only a dozen sentences toward the end, and I carefully hedged what I had to say in my usual Fed speak. Yet, when I showed the text to Alice Rivlin on the day of the speech, irrational exuberance jumped right out at her. "Are you sure you want to say this?" she asked. On the podium that night, I delivered the key passage, watching carefully to see how people would react. "As we move into the 21st century," I said, referring to the Fed, "the Congress willing, we will remain as the guardian of the purchasing power of the dollar. But one factor that will continue to complicate that task is the increasing difficulty of pinning down the notion of what constitutes a stable general price level. Where do we draw the line on what prices matter? Certainly, prices of goods and services now being produced, our basic measure of inflation, matter. But what about futures prices? Or more importantly, prices of claims on future goods and services, like equities, real estate, or other earning assets? Is stability of these prices essential to the stability of the economy? Clearly, sustained low inflation implies less uncertainty about the future, and lower risk premiums imply higher prices of stocks and other earning assets. We can see that in the inverse relationship exhibited by price-earnings ratios and the rate of inflation in the past. But how do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values, which then become subject to unexpected and prolonged contractions, as they have in Japan over the past decade? And how do we factor that assessment into monetary policy? We as central bankers need not be concerned if a collapsing financial asset bubble does not threaten to impair the real economy, its production, jobs, and price stability. Indeed, the sharp stock market break of 1987 had few negative consequences for the economy. But we should not underestimate or become complacent about the complexity of the interactions of asset markets and the economy. Admittedly, this was not Shakespeare. It was pretty hard to process, especially if you'd had a drink or two during the cocktail hour and were hungry for dinner to be served. When I came back to the table, I whispered to Andrea and the others seated there, "What part of that do you think will make news?" No one guessed, but I'd seen people in the audience sit up and take notice, and as the evening ended, the buzz began. "Fed chairman pops the big question, is the market too high?" wrote the Wall Street Journal the next day. "Irrational exuberance denounced," said the Philadelphia Inquirer. "A buried message loudly heard," said the New York Times. Irrational exuberance was on its way to becoming a catchphrase of the boom. But the stock market did not slow down, which only reinforced my concern. It's true that my remarks initially caused a sell-off around the world, partly on the suspicion that the Fed would immediately raise rates. Stock prices fell first in Japan's markets, where it was already morning when I spoke, then hours later as the markets opened in Europe, and finally in New York the following day. On the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow dropped almost 150 points at the opening bell. But by afternoon, the U.S. markets had bounced back, and after one more trading day, they had regained all the lost ground. America's stock markets ended the year up by well over 20%. And the bull charged on. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was already nearing 7,000 when the FOMC convened for the first time in 1997, on February 4th. By then, I knew from private conversations with many of the governors and bank presidents that the committee shared my worry that the development of a stock bubble might cause inflationary instability. Apart from the run-up in the stock market, the economy was as robust as it had been 6 months before, when I'd resisted the idea of tightening rates. But my concern about a bubble had changed my mind. I told the committee we might need an interest rate increase to try to rein in the bull. "We have to start thinking about some form of preemptive move," I said, "and how to communicate that." I was choosing my words very carefully because we were on the record and we were playing with political dynamite. The Fed has no explicit mandate under the law to try to contain a stock market bubble. Indirectly, we had the authority to do so, if we believed stock prices were creating inflationary pressures. But in this instance, that would have been a very hard case to make, because the economy was performing so well. The Fed does not operate in a vacuum. If we raised rates and gave as a reason that we wanted to rein in the stock market, it would have provoked a political firestorm. We'd have been accused of hurting the little investor, sabotaging people's retirements. I could imagine the grilling I'd get in the next congressional oversight hearing. All the same, we agreed that trying to avoid a bubble was consistent with our mission, and that it was our duty to take the chance. I mused aloud in our meeting that day, "We need above all to make certain that we keep inflation low, risk premiums low, the cost of capital low. If we are talking about long-term equilibrium, high market values are better than low market values. What we are trying to avoid is bubbles that break, volatility and the like." With the committee's consent, I hinted at an impending rate hike in my public remarks over the next several weeks. This was to keep from shocking the markets with an abrupt move. Then we met again on March 25th and raised short-term rates by 0.25% to 5.5%. I wrote the FOMC's statement announcing the decision myself. It talked purely in terms of the Fed's wish to address underlying economic forces that threatened to create inflation, and did not say a word about asset values or stocks. As I described the rate increase shortly afterward in a speech, "We took a small step to increase the odds that the good performance of the economy can continue." In late March and early April of 1997, right after our meeting, the Dow dipped by some 7%. This represented a loss of almost 500 points, to some minds a delayed reaction to our rate hike. But within a few weeks, the momentum shifted, and the market came roaring back. It recouped all of its losses and gained 10% more, so that by mid-June it was nearing 7,800. In effect, investors were teaching the Fed a lesson. Bob Rubin was right. You can't tell when a market is overvalued, and you can't fight market forces. As the boom went on, for 3 more years it turned out, greatly increasing the nation's paper wealth, we continued to wrestle with big questions of productivity and price stability and other aspects of what people had come to call the new economy. We looked for other ways to deal with the risk of a bubble, but we did not raise rates any further, and we never tried to rein in stock prices again. Andrea and I expressed some exuberance of our own by finally getting married that spring. She always jokes that it took me 3 tries to propose to her, because I kept popping the question in Fed speak. But that is not true. Actually, I proposed 5 times. She missed a couple. On Christmas Day 1996, though, the message finally got through, and she said yes. In April 1997, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg married us in a simple, beautiful ceremony at one of our favorite places, the Inn at Little Washington in the Virginia countryside. Typically, we put off having a honeymoon. Too much was happening in Andrea's professional world and mine. But friends kept urging us to go and recommended Venice. Finally, I studied my calendar and suggested adding a honeymoon to the tail end of an International Monetary Conference meeting in Interlaken, Switzerland, in June, 2 months after our wedding. At the Monetary Conference, German Chancellor Helmut Kohl gave a predictably dry luncheon speech. Central bank independence and the revaluation of Germany's gold reserves were the topics. Afterward, Andrea and I avoided flocks of reporters who wanted comments about the U.S. economic outlook and the prospects for the continuation of the internet boom on the stock market. Even though they knew it was my policy not to give interviews, some asked Andrea to serve as a go-between, figuring that as a fellow journalist she might be willing to help. All Andrea wanted to do was go to the spa. By the time we left Interlaken, she had jokingly declared our trip so far the least romantic honeymoon in history. And then we arrived in Venice. As necessary as creative destruction is for material standards of living to improve, it's no coincidence that some of the world's most cherished places are those that have changed the least over the centuries. I'd never visited the city, and like so many travelers before me, I was enchanted. Our notion had been to wander and do things completely spontaneously, and while that doesn't really happen when you are traveling with a security detail, we came close. We ate at open-air cafes, went shopping, and toured churches and the old Jewish ghetto. For centuries, the Venetian city-state was the center of world trade, linking Western Europe with the Byzantine Empire and the rest of the known world. After the Renaissance, trade routes shifted to the Atlantic, and Venice declined as a sea power. Yet, throughout the 1700s, it remained Europe's most graceful city, a center of literature, architecture, and art. What news on the Rialto, the famous line from The Merchant of Venice referring to the commercial heart of the city, still strikes a vibrant cosmopolitan note. Today, the Rialto district looks much as it did when traders unloaded silks and spices from the Orient. The same is true of the city's splendidly painted Renaissance palaces, St. Mark's Square, and dozens of other sites. Except for the motorized launches, the Vaporetti, you could just as readily be in the 17th or 18th century. As we strolled along one of the canals, my inner economist finally got the better of me. I asked Andrea, "What is the value added produced in this city?" "You're asking the wrong question," she replied, and burst out laughing. "But this entire city is a museum. Just think of what goes into keeping it up." Andrea stopped and looked at me. "You should be looking at how beautiful it is." Of course, my wife was right. But the conversation helped crystallize something that had been in the back of my mind for months. Venice, I realized, is the antithesis of creative destruction. It exists to conserve and appreciate a past, not create a future. But that, I realized, is exactly the point. The city caters to a deep human need for stability and permanence, as well as beauty and romance. Venice's popularity represents one pole of a conflict in human nature, the struggle between the desire to increase material well-being and the desire to ward off change and its attendant stress. America's material standard of living continues to improve, yet the dynamism of that same economy puts hundreds of thousands of people per week involuntarily out of work. It's no surprise that demands for protection against the forces of market competition are on the rise, as well as nostalgia for a slower and simpler time. Nothing is more stressful for people than the perennial gale of creative destruction. Silicon Valley is without question an exciting place to work, but its allure as a honeymoon destination has, I would guess, thus far gone largely unrecognized. The following evening in Venice, Andrea and I went to hear a Vivaldi cello concerto, played on Baroque instruments. His melodies filled the air around us, a thrilling complement to the somber majesty of the ancient church with its shadows and curves and thick stones that seemed to breathe the damp of the canals. I've heard Vivaldi played better, but never have I enjoyed it so much. Chapter 9. Millennium Fever. In the late 90s, the economy was so strong that I used to get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and say to myself, "Remember, this is temporary. This is not the way the world is supposed to work." I loved watching the economy flourish, as well as the strange new challenges this prosperity brought on. The emergence of a federal budget surplus, for example. This wondrous happening first occurred in 1998. It came after a run of 5 years during which the federal deficit dwindled steadily from the fiscal year 1992 peak of almost $300 billion. The surplus derived from factors we thought we understood, fiscal conservatism and economic growth. But the scale of the change was far beyond that. No one at the Fed or elsewhere anticipated the emergence in fiscal year 2000 of the largest surplus relative to GDP since 1948. History told us booms like this couldn't and wouldn't last forever, yet this one was lasting longer than I'd believed it could. Throughout the late 90s, the economy grew at a better than 4% annual rate. That translated to $400 billion or so of prosperity, equal in size to the entire economy of the former Soviet Union being added to the U.S. economy each year. Virtually every household benefited. Gene Sperling, the Clinton economic advisor, liked to call attention to the breadth of the social effects. Between 1993 and 2000, the typical American family had a real gain in annual income of $8,000. This economic growth boosted the national psyche, changing the way we saw ourselves in the world. Throughout the 1980s and well into the early 1990s, Americans had gone through a period of being fearful and depressed. People worried we were losing ground to Germany, the newly unifying Europe, and Japan. As Larry Summers later described it, these economic rivals were more investment-oriented, more manufacturing-oriented, had fewer lawyers, more scientists, more discipline than we. In the 80s, Japan's giant zaibatsu, or conglomerates, had seemed to pose a particular threat. They had usurped America in steel and in factory equipment, put our automakers on the defensive, and so completely overwhelmed us in consumer electronics that even the TVs we depended on for news bore Sony, Panasonic, and Hitachi brands. Not since Sputnik had America felt itself to be at such a scary disadvantage. Even the end of the Cold War didn't lift the gloom. Our vast military power suddenly felt irrelevant, and international status was now defined by economic prowess. Then the technology boom came along and changed everything. It made America's freewheeling, entrepreneurial, so-what-if-you-fail business culture the envy of the world. U.S. information technology swept the global market, as did innovations ranging from Starbucks lattes to credit derivatives. Students gravitated from other countries to American universities. The changes the United States had undertaken to modernize its economy, 2 decades of often painful deregulation and downsizing and the lowering of barriers to trade, all now paid off. While both Europe and Japan slid into economic doldrums, America was on the rise. The federal budget surplus was an amazing development. "We all need to go back to the drawing board on forecasting taxes," a senior official of the New York Fed told the FOMC in May 1997, after a report that the Treasury's receipts for the year were running $50 billion ahead of projections. Economists at the Office of Management and Budget, the Congressional Budget Office, and the Fed were all at sea. Even though the economy was on a roll, it wasn't enough to account for this big a surge in tax receipts. We suspected we might be seeing a stock market effect, and I encouraged the Fed staff to accelerate its work estimating the boost to household taxable income from the exercise of stock option grants and realized capital gains. Stock options, of course, had become the primary lure used by tech companies to attract and keep employees. They were even being handed out to secretaries and clerks. It was very difficult to measure accurately this new source of wealth. Years later, this hypothesis was proved correct, but at the time, all our economists could do was to confirm that it might be the case. The federal deficit for 1997 shrank to just $22 billion, statistically insignificant in the context of a $1.6 trillion federal budget and a $10 trillion GDP. Almost overnight, the administration found itself facing a budget surplus that was expanding as fast as the deficit had dwindled. President Clinton had no sooner started talking about the possibility of actually being able to balance the federal budget in 1998 than his policymakers had to scramble to plan what to do with the surplus. And while this was a happy problem to have, success, like everything else in budgetary matters, must be managed. This is particularly so in Washington, where if politicians discover $1 billion, they will instantly come up with at least $20 billion worth of ways to spend it. And the surplus looked to be truly epic, The Congressional Budget Office projection in 1998 was for it to total $660 billion over 10 years. The $660 billion figure from the Congressional Budget Office was the sum of projections from 1999 to 2008. Meanwhile, the White House envisioned surpluses in the next decade to total $1.1 trillion. The discrepancy reflected, in part, the fact that CBO projections are based on current law, while administration projections assume that the administration's policies will be enacted. As soon as the news was announced, both parties claimed credit. Republican fiscal policy, emphasizing controlled spending, less government, and tax relief, has moved the nation from deficit to surplus in just 3 years, declared a GOP leader, Congressman John Boehner of Ohio. President Clinton, for his part, formally announced the surplus at a special White House ceremony where Democratic leaders were present but Republicans were banned. Not a single Republican had voted for his milestone deficit reduction budget in 1993, the president reminded the audience, adding that if they had, they would have been eligible to be here today. Predictably, dissension about what to do with the extra revenue was intense. Liberal Democrats wanted to devote the money to social programs they said had been shortchanged for years. Conservative Republicans proposed to give back the surplus in the form of tax cuts. Bill Archer, a Republican from Texas and a good friend who was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, won the prize for the most amusing statement of the debate. "Because of record-high taxation," he declared, tongue-in-cheek, "the surplus is raging out of control." Fiscal conservatives like Bob Rubin and me, meanwhile, believed that neither tax cuts nor new spending was the right way to go. We thought the surplus should be used to pay down the national debt to the public. It now totaled $3.7 trillion, the accumulated consequence of a quarter century of deficit spending. The last year the budget had been in surplus was 1969. My long-time involvement in Social Security reform had made me all too aware that, in the not-too-far-off future, Social Security and Medicare would face demands in the trillions of dollars as the baby boom generation aged. There was no practical way to pay those obligations in advance. The most effective policy would be to pay down the debt, creating in the process additional savings, which in turn could increase the nation's productive capacity and federal revenues at existing tax rates by the time the boomers hit retirement age. Debt repayment had one other advantage. It was the simplest option. So long as Congress does not pass legislation appropriating the money for some other use, any surplus revenues that flow into government coffers automatically pay down the debt. If only Congress could keep its hands out of the cash box. Or, as I suggested more diplomatically to the Senate Budget Committee, the accumulated national debt was so massive that the government could happily whittle away at it for years. It will not harm the economy in any way of which I am aware to allow the surpluses to run for quite a long period of time before you touch them, I said. If the surpluses are evolving, let's not look at them as though they are a threat to the economy. They are surely not. It had not yet entered my mind that surpluses could become so large as to reduce the debt level to zero and eventually could require the federal government to accumulate private assets. That prospect would confront me in 2001. Yet, compared with tax cuts or spending increases, debt repayment was admittedly an ugly duckling policy. I wondered whether Clinton would be able to stick with the fiscal conservatism that had marked his first term, even if he wanted to. I played no role in finding the answer, but I had to admire the one Clinton and his policymakers came up with. They lit on a politically irrefutable argument to take the money off the table, tying the budget surplus to Social Security. He delivered his pitch as part of the 1998 State of the Union address. "What should we do with this projected surplus? I have a simple four-word answer. Save Social Security first. Tonight, I propose that we reserve 100% of the surplus, that's every penny of any surplus, until we have taken all the necessary measures to strengthen the Social Security system for the 21st century." The crux of Clinton's necessary measures, it quickly emerged, was to set aside the lion's share of any surplus to pay down the debt. I was impressed that Clinton had preempted much of the debate that would have arisen had he focused on debt reduction pure and simple. "I'm amazed," I told Gene Sperling. "You've found a way to make debt reduction politically attractive." As the budget surpluses mounted over the next few years, all the way from $70 billion in 1998 to $124 billion in 1999 and to $237 billion in 2000, I watched Congress grab again and again for the money. In the summer of 1999, the Republicans put forward a plan to cut taxes by almost $800 billion over 10 years, and the Senate Banking Committee summoned me to testify whether the plan made long-term economic sense. I had to tell them it did not, or at least not yet. "We probably would be better off holding off on a tax cut," I said, "largely because of the fact that it is apparent that the surpluses are doing a great deal of positive good to the economy." I had two other arguments, I added. First, while projections of the surplus over the next decade were now up to $3 trillion, uncertainty about the economy put those big numbers in doubt. "They could just as rapidly go in the other direction," I said. Second, given how strong the economy already was, the stimulus of a major tax cut might cause it to overheat. On the other hand, I said, I saw no problem in delaying such a cut. These observations made a few headlines, but did not dissuade Congress from proceeding with the bill. It passed a week later, only to be vetoed by the president. At a time when America is moving in the right direction, this bill would turn us back to the failed policies of the past, he said as he signed the veto in the Rose Garden. President Clinton's old-fashioned attitude toward debt might have had a more lasting effect on the nation's priorities. Instead, his influence was diluted by the uproar about Monica Lewinsky, whose name surfaced in news reports just days before he unveiled his approach for the surplus. As the scandal unfolded and details of their alleged encounters appeared in the press, I was incredulous. "There is no way these stories could be correct," I told my friends. "I've been in the area of the White House between the Oval Office and the private dining room. There are staff people and Secret Service in and out all the time. No way." Later, when it came out that the accounts were true, I wondered how the president could take such a risk. It seemed so alien to the Bill Clinton I knew and made me feel disappointed and sad. And it had a devastating effect. You could see it, for example, in a pair of headlines that appeared side by side on CNN's website. Lewinsky set to provide handwriting fingerprint samples, and Clinton announces $39 billion projected budget surplus. While America was booming, the rest of the world shook. In the wake of the end of the Cold War and the demise of much central planning, developing nations were seeking ways to attract direct foreign investment by further securing property rights and opening up larger sectors of their economies. But as part of those initiatives, an unsettling pattern started to emerge. U.S. investors, rich with capital gains from the U.S. boom, would crowd into unfamiliar emerging markets in search of diversification. Big banks would come too, seeking higher returns on loans than they could get in the United States, where interest rates had now reached near historic lows. To attract such capital and promote trade, some developing nations tied their currency to the dollar at a fixed exchange rate. In that way, U.S. and foreign investors could consider themselves protected from exchange rate risk at least for a while. The borrowers of the dollars, meanwhile, would convert them into the domestic currency and lend the money within the developing country at the prevailing high interest rates. By doing so, they were gambling that when the loan was repaid, they'd be able to convert the money back into dollars at the fixed exchange rate and repay their own dollar borrowings with no exchange rate loss. When shrewd market players who didn't believe in the tooth fairy realized that the developing countries could maintain the fixed exchange rate regime only so long, and they started to sell the domestic currencies for dollars, the game was up. Central banks trying to hold their dollar exchange rate fixed rapidly ran out of their reserves of dollars. This sequence of events led to the so-called Asian contagion, a series of financial crises that began with the collapse of the Thai baht and the Malaysian ringgit in the summer of 1997 and grew into a threat to the world economy. Almost immediately, Thailand and Malaysia plunged into recession. The economies of Hong Kong, the Philippines, and Singapore were hard hit too. In Indonesia, a nation of 200 million people, the rupiah imploded, the stock market collapsed, and the ensuing economic disarray led to food riots, widespread misery, and eventually the fall of President Suharto. Just as during Mexico's crisis 2 years before, the International Monetary Fund moved in with financial support. Bob Rubin, Larry Summers, and the Treasury Department again spearheaded the U.S. response. The Fed again played largely an advisory role. I got more deeply involved only in November, when a senior official at the Bank of Japan called the Fed to warn that South Korea would be the next to go. "The dam is bursting," is how the official put it, explaining that Japanese banks had lost confidence in Korea and were about to stop renewing tens of billions of dollars in loans. This was a shock. A symbol of Asia's remarkable growth, South Korea was now the world's 11th largest economy, twice the size of Russia. Korea was so successful that it was no longer even considered a developing nation. The World Bank officially listed it as part of the First World. And while market watchers knew that there had been problems recently, the economy, by all indications, was still growing solidly and fast. Korea's central bank was also sitting on $25 billion in dollar reserves, ample protection against the Asian contagion, or so we thought. What we didn't know, but soon discovered, was that the government had played games with those reserves. It had quietly sold or lent most of the dollars to South Korean commercial banks, which in turn had used them to shore up bad loans. So when Charlie Siegman, one of our top international economists, phoned a Korean central banker on Thanksgiving weekend and asked, "Why don't you release more of your reserves?" the banker answered, "We don't have any." What they'd published as reserves had already been spoken for. This mess took weeks to unwind. Rubin's task forces worked virtually around the clock, and the IMF assembled a financial support package of $55 billion, its largest financial rescue ever. The deal required the cooperation of Kim Dae-jung, Korea's newly elected president, whose first major decision was to commit to stringent economic reforms. Part of the challenge for the Treasury and the Fed, meanwhile, was to talk scores of the world's largest banks into not calling in their Korea loans. All these initiatives came to a head at the same time, prompting Bob to say in retrospect, "We must have set some kind of record for disturbing the slumber of finance ministers and central bankers all over the world." There was always the chance that a rescue this large would set a bad precedent. How many more times would investors pour money into willing but shaky economies, figuring that if they got into big enough trouble, the IMF would bail them out? This was a version of what the insurance industry calls the moral hazard of protecting individuals from risk. The bigger the safety net, the theory goes, the greater the recklessness with which people, businesses, or governments will tend to behave. Yet the consequences of allowing South Korea to default would have been worse, possibly far worse. A default by a nation of Korea's size would almost certainly have destabilized global markets. Major banks in Japan and elsewhere would likely have failed, sending additional tremors through the system. Shell-shocked investors would have withdrawn not just from East Asia, but from Latin America and other emerging regions, causing development to stall. Credit would very likely have become much tighter in the industrialized nations as well. And that is leaving aside the military risk unique to South Korea's situation. For their handling of that crisis alone, Bob Rubin and Larry Summers belong in the Finance Minister's Hall of Fame. In the United States, things were still booming as the Internet wove itself into people's lifestyles. The computer in the household was becoming as essential as the phone, the refrigerator, and the TV. It became a way to get news. In summer 1997, millions had gone online to view dazzling photos from Pathfinder, the first U.S. probe to set down successfully on Mars in 20 years. And it became a way to shop. In 1998, e-commerce arrived in a big way, with people flocking to websites like Amazon and eToys and eBay, especially during the holiday season. But the Asian contagion wasn't finished with us yet. The grim scenario we'd imagined in the Korean crisis came perilously close to being realized 8 months later. In August 1998, Russia defaulted on a vast dollar debt. Like the crises in Asia, Russia's resulted from the toxic interaction of overeager investing by foreigners and irresponsible management at home. The precipitating factor was a drop in the price of oil, which eventually hit $11 a barrel, the lowest level in 25 years, as the economic impact of the Asian crises sapped worldwide demand. Since oil was a major Russian export, this meant big trouble for the Kremlin. Suddenly, Russia could no longer afford to pay the interest on its debts. I'd last visited Moscow 7 years before, on the eve of the Soviet Union's dissolution, and still remembered the high hopes of the economic reformers and the gray desolation on the streets. Conditions, if anything, were now worse. In the vacuum left by the collapse of central planning, Boris Yeltsin's economists had tried and failed to foster reliable markets to supply food, clothing, and other essentials. Families and businesses got by largely off the books, with the result that the government could not even collect the taxes it needed to provide basic services or pay its debts. Oligarchs had come to control large shares of the nation's resources and wealth, and inflation periodically ran rampant, amplifying the misery of tens of millions of Russians on limited incomes. The government had singularly failed to establish, or even to comprehend the need for, property rights and the rule of law. As the crisis unfolded, the IMF again stood ready with financial aid. It announced a $23 billion support package in July. But as soon as Russia received the first payments, its parliament made clear that it had no intention of accepting the usual IMF conditions of better fiscal management and economic reform. This defiance prompted the IMF to conclude that sending the rest of the aid would be throwing good money after bad. It would only postpone and probably worsen the inevitable default. By mid-August, the Russian Central Bank had burned through more than half of its foreign exchange reserves. Frenzied last-minute diplomacy failed, and on August 26th, the Central Bank withdrew support for the ruble. The exchange rate fell 38% overnight. The IMF package was withdrawn. The default, when it came, stunned investors and banks that had poured money into Russia in spite of the obvious risks. Many operated on the assumption that the West would always bail out the fallen superpower, if for no other reason, the saying went, than that Russia was too nuclear to fail. Those investors bet wrong. The United States and its allies had worked quietly and effectively to help Yeltsin's government keep its warheads under lock and key. It turned out that the Russians were much better at controlling an arsenal than at managing an economy. So, after careful deliberation, President Clinton and other leaders judged that the IMF's withdrawal would not increase the nuclear risk and approved its decision to pull the plug. We all held our breath. Sure enough, the shock wave from Russia's default hit Wall Street much harder than the Asian crises had. In the last four trading days of August alone, the Dow lost more than 1,000 points, or 12% of its value. The bond markets reacted even more strongly as investors fled to the safety of treasuries. Banks, too, pulled back from new lending and raised interest rates on commercial loans. Lurking behind all these expressions of uncertainty was the growing fear that after seven spectacular years, the U.S. economic boom was coming to an end. That fear, it turned out, was premature. Once we coped with the Russian crisis, the boom would continue for another 2 years, until late 2000, when the business cycle finally turned. But I could see the dangers, and I felt we needed to address them. In early September, I had a long-planned date to speak to an audience of business scholars at the University of California at Berkeley. I'd intended to talk about technology and the economy, touching on productivity, innovation, virtuous cycles, and the like. But as the day drew near, I decided I couldn't limit my focus to the domestic economy, not after what had just happened in Russia. America's problem was not that the U.S. economy had run out of steam. It was that the imbalances caused by the technology revolution and rapidly globalizing markets were straining the world's financial systems. In my talk, I noted the impact of the turmoil abroad. Up to now, I said, all it had done was hold down prices and slow demand for U.S. products. But I warned that as dislocations abroad mounted, feeding back on our financial markets, these effects would likely intensify. That dimmed the economic outlook. It is just not credible that the United States can remain an oasis of prosperity unaffected by a world that is experiencing greatly increased stress, I said. We could never gain the full benefits of the technology revolution unless the rest of the world shared in the growth. The standard of living in every nation we did business with had to be a matter of concern. For many in the audience who'd been riding the wave of the high-tech revolution, this probably came as news. I don't think my oasis of prosperity remark made much of an impact that day. But the idea was meant to have a long fuse. I wasn't talking about the next 6 months or the next year. America's isolationism runs so deep that people still haven't let it go. There's always a presumption that since America is better, we should go it alone. I told the Berkeley audience that the Russian crisis had prompted a major rethinking at the Fed. We'd been so focused on domestic inflation that we hadn't paid enough attention to the warning signs of a possible international financial breakdown. This was the part of the speech the media picked up. Wall Street read my message loud and clear that the FOMC was poised to lower interest rates. The threat of a worldwide recession seemed increasingly real to me, and I was convinced that the Fed did not have the power to cope alone. The financial pressures we faced were on a global scale, and the effort to contain them would have to be global too. Bob Rubin shared this view. Behind the scenes, he and I began contacting the finance ministers and central bankers of the G7 nations to try to coordinate a policy response. We argued, quietly but urgently, for the need to increase liquidity and ease interest rates throughout the developed world. Some of our counterparts proved very difficult to convince. But at last, as the markets in Europe closed on September 14th, the G7 issued a carefully written statement. "The balance of risks in the world economy has shifted," it declared. It went on to detail how G7 policy would shift too, from single-mindedly battling inflation toward also fostering growth. As Rubin noted eloquently in his memoir, as bland as those 10 words may have seemed, they marked a major change in the global financial picture. Every war has its weapons, and when you're dealing with volatile financial markets and jittery investors, the subtleties of a carefully crafted communique, signed by the top financial authorities in the world's 7 largest industrialized countries, can make a crucial difference. None of this did much at first to ease the sense of impending doom. Brazil became the latest victim of a malaise, and Rubin and Summers spent most of September working with the IMF to craft a rescue. Meanwhile, Bill McDonough, the head of the New York Fed, took on the challenge of coping with the implosion of one of Wall Street's largest and most successful hedge funds, Long-Term Capital Management. Hollywood could not have scripted a more dramatic financial train wreck. Despite its boring name, LTCM was a proud, high-visibility, high-prestige operation in Greenwich, Connecticut that earned spectacular returns investing a $125 billion portfolio for wealthy clients. Among its principals were 2 Nobel laureate economists, Myron Scholes and Robert Merton, whose state-of-the-art mathematical models were at the heart of the firm's money machine. LTCM specialized in risky, lucrative arbitrage deals in U.S., Japanese, and European bonds, leveraging its bets with more than $120 billion borrowed from banks. It also carried some $1.25 trillion in financial derivatives, exotic contracts that were only partly reflected on its balance sheet. Some of these were speculative investments, and some were engineered to hedge or insure LTCM's portfolio against every imaginable risk. Even after the smoke cleared, no one ever knew for sure how highly leveraged LTCM was when things started to go wrong. The best estimates were that it had invested well over $35 for every $1 it actually owned. The Russian default turned out to be the iceberg for this financial Titanic. That development contorted the markets in a way even the Nobel winners had never imagined. LTCM's fortunes reversed so abruptly that its elaborate safeguards never had a chance to work. Practically overnight, its stunned founders watched the nearly $5 billion in capital they'd built up drain away. The New York Fed, whose job it is to help maintain order in Wall Street's markets, tracked LTCM's death spiral. Ordinarily, a business that makes a fatal blunder ought to be left to fail. But the markets were already spooked and skittish. Bill McDonough worried that if a company of LTCM's size had to dump its assets on the market, prices could collapse. That would set off a chain reaction that would bankrupt other firms. So when he called to say he decided to intervene, I wasn't happy with the idea, but I couldn't disagree. The story of how he godfathered LTCM's bailout by its creditors has been told so many times that it is part of Wall Street lore. He literally gathered top officials of 16 of the world's most powerful banks and investment houses in a room, suggested strongly that if they fully comprehended the losses they would face in a forced fire sale of LTCM's assets, they would work it out, and left. After days of increasingly tense negotiations, the bankers came up with an infusion of $3.5 billion for LTCM. That bought the firm the time it needed to dissolve in an orderly way. No taxpayer money was spent, except perhaps for some sandwiches and coffee, but the Fed's intervention touched a populist raw nerve. "Seeing a fund as too big to fail, New York Fed assists its bailout," trumpeted the New York Times on its front page. A few days later, on October 1st, McDonough and I were called before the House Banking Committee to explain why, as USA Today put it, a private firm designed for millionaires should be saved by a plan that was brokered and supported by a federal government organization. The criticism came from both sides of the aisle. Congressman Mike Castle, a Delaware Republican, half-jokingly said that his mutual funds and real estate investments weren't doing so well, but no one is helping me out. And Congressman Bruce Vento, a Democrat from Minnesota, complained that we were shielding rich people from the harsh effects of market forces that often caused misery for the little guy. There seem to be two rules, he said, one for Main Street and another one for Wall Street. But telling the banks involved with LTCM that they might save themselves money if they facilitated an orderly liquidation of the fund was by no stretch of the imagination a bailout. By facing the harsh reality and acting in their self-interest, they saved themselves, and I suspect millions of their fellow citizens on both Main Street and Wall Street, a lot of money. I was tracking the signs of trouble in the financial world with mounting concern for how all this might damage the economy. At a speaking engagement on October 7th, after 30-year Treasury bonds hit their lowest interest rates in 30 years, I threw away my prepared remarks and told an audience of economists, "I've been watching the U.S. markets for 50 years, and I have never seen anything like this." Specifically, I said, investors in the bond market were behaving irrationally, paying substantially extra for the newest, most liquid Treasury bonds, even though slightly older but less liquid ones were equally safe. This rush to liquidity was unprecedented, I noted, and reflected not judgment, but panic. They basically are saying, "I want out. I don't want to know anything about whether an investment is risky or not. I can't stand the pain. I just want out." The economists knew precisely what I was getting at. Panic in a market is like liquid nitrogen. It could quickly cause a devastating freeze. And indeed, the Fed's research was already showing that banks were increasingly hesitant to lend. It took no argument at all to get the FOMC to lower interest rates. We did so three times in rapid succession between September 29th and November 17th. Other European and Asian central banks, honoring their new G7 commitment, also eased their rates. Gradually, as we'd hoped, the medicine took hold. The world's markets calmed down, and a year and a half after the Asian crises began, Bob Rubin was finally able to take an uninterrupted family vacation. The way the Fed responded to the Russian crisis reflected a gradually evolving departure from the policymaking textbook. Instead of putting all our energy into achieving the single best forecast and then betting everything on that, we based our policy response on a range of possible scenarios. When Russia defaulted, the Fed's mathematical models showed that it was highly likely that the U.S. economy would continue expanding at a healthy pace in spite of Russia's problems and with no action by the Fed. Yet we opted to ease interest rates all the same because of a small but real risk that the default might disrupt global financial markets enough to severely affect the United States. That was a new kind of trade-off for us. We judged this unlikely but potentially greatly destabilizing event to be a greater threat to economic prosperity than the higher inflation that easier money might cause. I suspect there had been many such decisions in the Fed's past, but the underlying decision-making process had never been made systematic or explicit. Weighing costs and benefits systematically in this way gradually came to dominate our policy-making approach. I liked it because it generalized from a number of ad hoc decisions we'd made in years past. It let us reach beyond econometric models to factor in broader, though less mathematically precise, hypotheses about how the world works. Importantly, it also opened the door to the lessons of history. For example, by letting us explore how the railroad boom of the 1870s might hold clues to behavior in the markets during the internet craze. Some economists still argue that such an approach to policy is too undisciplined, overly complex, seemingly discretionary, difficult to explain. They want the Fed to set interest rates according to formal benchmarks and rules. We should manage the economy, say, to achieve an optimal level of employment, or by targeting a set rate of inflation. I agree that sensible policies can be made only with the help of rigorous analytic structures. But too often we have to deal with incomplete and faulty data, unreasoning human fear, and inadequate legal clarity. As elegant as modern-day econometrics has become, it is not up to the task of delivering policy prescriptions. the world economy has become too complex and interlinked. Our policymaking process must evolve in response to that complexity. I suppose we might have guessed that the last year of the millennium would be the wildest, giddiest boom year of all. Euphoria swept the U.S. markets in 1999, partly because the East Asian crises hadn't done us in. If we'd made it through those, the thinking went, then the future was bright for as far as the eye could see. What made this optimism so infectious was that it had a basis in fact. Driven by technological innovation and helped by strong consumer demand and other factors, the economy was booming right along. Yet while the opportunities were real, the degree of hype was surreal. You couldn't open the paper or read a magazine without encountering stories of the latest high-tech zillionaires. The head of a major consulting company made headlines when he quit to start Webvan, a company meant to deliver groceries ordered over the Internet. It raised $375 million in its initial public offering. Some London fashionistas I'd never heard of founded something called Boo.com, an apparel website that raised $135 million with a scheme to become the leading global seller of trendy sportswear. Everybody, it seemed, had an uncle or a neighbor who'd made big gains on Internet stock. The Fed, where people are constrained by conflict of interest rules from financial speculation, was probably one of the few places in America where you could ride an elevator without overhearing stock tips. Like scores of other Internet startups, Webvan and Boo.com flamed out in 2001 and 2000, respectively. The Internet boom became part of TV news, not just on the networks, of which I am a faithful viewer because of Andrea, but also on CNBC and other upstart cable channels that catered to business people and investors. On Super Bowl Sunday of 2000, half the 30-second ad slots were bought by 17 Internet startups for $2.2 million each. The Pets.com sock puppet appeared alongside Budweiser's Clydesdales and Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz in a FedEx spot. In pop culture, I was right up there with the sock puppets. CNBC invented a gimmick called the briefcase indicator, in which cameras would follow me on the mornings of FOMC meetings as I arrived at the Fed. If my briefcase was thin, the theory went, then my mind was untroubled and the economy was well. But if it was stuffed full, it meant I'd been burning the midnight oil and a rate hike loomed. For the record, the briefcase indicator was not accurate. The fatness of my briefcase was solely a function of whether I had packed my lunch. People would stop me on the street and thank me for their 401k. I'd be cordial in response, though I admit I occasionally felt tempted to say, "Madam, I had nothing to do with your 401k. It's a very uncomfortable feeling to be complimented for something you didn't do. Andrea, who was by turns exasperated and amused, kept a box filled with green spanalia, cartoons and postcards and clippings that were especially strange, not to mention Alan Greenspan t-shirts and even a doll. Undoubtedly, I could have avoided some of this. It would have been easy to duck the cameras, for example, by driving into the Fed's garage. But I was in the habit of walking those last several blocks to the office, and once they started doing the briefcase indicator, I didn't want to give the impression I was hiding. Besides, it wasn't mean-spirited. Why be a killjoy? The briefcase indicator was not a good way to convey monetary policy, however. Often, the ideas we needed to present were subtle and had to be thought through, making them poor fodder for sound bites as well. If sound bites had been our only contact with the media, I'd have been extremely concerned. But the Fed got a great deal of expert coverage. While it was my practice to avoid on-the-record interviews, my door was open to serious reporters. When someone called with questions for an important story, I'd often take the time to meet on background and talk through the ideas. This practice helped print journalists more than it did TV people, Andrea was quick to point out, but I couldn't do anything about that. In the midst of all this craziness, there was still real work to do. In the fall, Larry Summers and I had to settle a major turf war between the Treasury and the Fed. What had set it off was a push by Congress to overhaul the laws governing America's financial industries, banks, insurance companies, investment houses, real estate companies, and the like. Years in the making, the Financial Services Modernization Act finally did away with the Glass-Steagall Act, the Depression-era law that limited the ability of banks, investment firms, and insurance companies to enter one another's markets. Banks and other companies were eager to diversify, They wanted to be able, for instance, to offer customers one-stop shopping for financial services. They argued that they were losing ground to foreign competitors, especially European and Japanese universal banks that operated under no such restrictions. I agreed that liberalization in these markets was long overdue. The Treasury, through the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, was responsible for the supervision of all nationally chartered banks. The Fed oversaw bank holding companies and state-chartered institutions that chose to be regulated by the Fed. The version of the reform bill that had been passed by the Senate assigned responsibility mostly to the Fed. The House version favored the Treasury. After endless efforts to reconcile the two versions, Congress threw up its hands and gave our institutions until October 14th to settle it ourselves. So the Fed and Treasury staffs began to negotiate. This wasn't quite the OK Corral, but there was plenty of friction. The Treasury and the Comptroller's staff felt that all the regulatory authority should belong to them, and the Fed staff felt the same. Working day and night, they were able to solve a number of issues, but by October 14th, they'd fought to a standstill on others. They had a whole list of irreconcilable differences. I suspected tempers were running high. As it happened, October 14th was the day slated for Larry and me to have our weekly breakfast. We looked at each other and said, "We have to settle this thing." That afternoon, I went over to his office, and we shut the door. He and I are a lot alike. We both like to argue from basic principles and from evidence. I'm sorry we didn't have a tape recorder running, because this was a textbook case of policymaking by rational compromise. We sat and argued point by point. Periodically, I'd say, "Your argument sounds more credible than mine," and the Treasury Department would carry that point. On other issues, Larry would accept the Fed's argument. After an hour or two, we'd divided the pie. Treasury and the Fed came together on a single bill, and up it went that day to Capitol Hill, where it passed. Historians view the Financial Services Modernization Act as a milestone of business legislation, and I'll always remember it as an unsung moment of policymaking for which there ought to be a little song. The boom rose to a crescendo late in the year, with the Nasdaq stock market index at the end of December having nearly doubled in 12 months. The Dow rose 20%. Most people who'd invested in stocks were feeling flush, and with good reason. This presented the Fed with a fascinating puzzle. How do you draw the line between a healthy, exciting economic boom and a wanton, speculative stock market bubble driven by the less savory aspects of human nature? As I pointed out dryly to the House Banking Committee, the question is all the more complicated because the two can coexist. The interpretation that we are currently enjoying productivity acceleration does not ensure that equity prices are not overextended. An example that intrigued me was the epic multi-billion-dollar competition involving Quest, Global Crossing, MCI, Level 3, and other telecom companies. Like the railroad entrepreneurs of the 19th century, they were racing to expand the Internet by laying thousands of miles of fiber-optic cable. The link to the railroads is not merely metaphorical. Quest, for one, actually built fiber-optic networks using old railroad rights-of-way. There was nothing wrong with this. Demand for bandwidth was increasing exponentially, except that each competitor was laying enough cable to accommodate 100% of the projected overall demand. So while something of great value was being built, it seemed clear that most of the competitors would lose, the value of their stock would plunge, and billions of dollars of their shareholders' capital would evaporate. I'd given a lot of thought to whether we were experiencing a stock market bubble, and if we were, what to do about it. If the market were to fall 30% or 40% in a short time, I reasoned, I'd be willing to stipulate that, yes, there had been a bubble. But this implied that if I wanted to identify a bubble, I had to confidently predict that the market was going to drop by 30% or 40% in a short time. That was a tough position to take. Even if the Fed were to decide there was a stock bubble and we wanted to let the air out of it, would we be able to, I wondered. We had tried and failed. In early 1994, the FOMC began a 3 percentage point tightening that lasted a year. We did it to address a concern that inflationary pressures were building. But I could not fail to notice that as we tightened, the nascent stock market advance that had carried through most of 1993 went flat. Then, when our tightening episode came to an end in February 1995, stock prices resumed their rise. We tightened again in 1997, only to see stock prices again resume their rise after the rate move. We seemed, in effect, to be ratcheting up the long-term price trend. If Fed tightening could not knock stock prices down by weakening the economy and profits, owning stocks became a seemingly ever less risky activity. Our modest forays, therefore, had only set the stage for further increases in stock prices. A giant rate hike would be a different story. I had no doubt that by abruptly raising interest rates by, say, 10 percentage points, we could explode any bubble overnight. But we would do so by devastating the economy, wiping out the very growth we sought to protect. We'd be killing the patient to cure the disease. I was reasonably certain that seeking to diffuse a mounting bubble with incremental tightening, as many had recommended, would be counterproductive. Unless the tightening broke the back of the economic boom, and with it profits, an incremental tightening would, in my experience, reinforce the perceived power of the boom. Modest tightening was more likely to raise stock prices than to lower them. After thinking a great deal about this, I decided that the best the Fed could do would be to stay with our central goal of stabilizing product and services prices. By doing that job well, we would gain the power and flexibility needed to limit economic damage if there was a crash. That became the consensus within the FOMC. In the event of a major market decline, we agreed, our policy would be to move aggressively, lowering rates and flooding the system with liquidity to mitigate the economic fallout. But the idea of addressing the stock market boom directly and preemptively seemed out of our reach. A few eyebrows were raised when I presented this back-to-basics philosophy to Congress in 1999. I said I was still worried that stock prices might be too high, but that the Fed would not second-guess hundreds of thousands of informed investors. Instead, the Fed would position itself to protect the economy in the event of a crash. While bubbles that burst are scarcely benign, the consequences need not be catastrophic for the economy, I told the legislators. Reflecting on this, the New York Times editorialized, "That sounds markedly different from the old Greenspan, who 30 months ago warned investors against irrational